Welcome to Cinemakers, Steven Soderbergh. This is episode 15, K Street, from 2003. I am Tobin Addington.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And a confession right up front, I only watched one of these 10 episodes because I hated it.
Wow. In this corner, we have Joey. And in the other corner, we have Tobin. And I think I'm right sort of down the middle.
I know that Tobin really likes this. This is not news to them that I bailed on the series so quick. I watched the pilot twice. This is a one-series TV show from 2003, which the more I sort of learned about the production, and Tobin can describe that because I learned from him, the more I was into it, but still on a whole, I was like, I'm good.
I made it the whole way through. I'll just let you know. It was sort of a marathon. I binged a few episodes this morning to make it to the end, but like I don't know. Like, I liked some of it. We'll talk about where it goes. Well, I guess Tobin and I will tell Joey what happens, you know? But, like, I did not feel satisfied by the end story-wise, but I gotta admit, like, I was intrigued as to where it was trying to go.
Yeah, this is a puzzle, this show. I wouldn't say that I like it. This is not something that I'm gonna put on for fun anytime. But I really am fascinated by it, and I think it's worth considering. And I think that there are, especially in terms of when you think about the way it was made and the time in which it was made and some of the issues that come up over the course of the show and the way that this is the only way you could make this kind of show, I think I find it a kind of a fascinating experiment that doesn't sort of ends in more of a whimper. It sort of starts with a bang for me and ends at a whimper. And I, you know, Joey, it does not get better. If you don't like the beginning, like it's not like there's some revelation along the way that you're going to be like, it's going to, you know, turn you around. But I think along the way, there are moments that are really worth the journey.
Another issue I think that we could all agree on is that since this show, and this may have been, you know, early on and inspiration for many of them, there's just a lot of these sort of political, I don't want to say this is quite a satire, but there's a lot of these sort of behind the political scenes shows that have come since then that are just like way, way better. So going back to watch like the sort of proto version of all of those things like Veep and such in ways, you know, yeah, it just doesn't hold up to what's come after. And I think that's part of an issue too.
I think my biggest problem off the bat was that this is billed on IMDb as both a comedy and a drama. And I was like, why isn't it funny? And then Tobin said, well, it's not a comedy. And I was like, oh, okay. Because the thing that's the most jarring about this is that it's shot, these adjectives you might take offense to, Tobin, I'm not sure, but it feels like it's shot dirty and cheap and quick in a way that, like, because you're saying that they're filming this week to week to get it out on that week's news, right?
Yeah, so this is really key to understanding the show. Two things. One, that the two stars of the show, James Carville and Mary Madeline, are a husband and wife, real life, political strategist, consultants. He's a Democrat, she's a Republican. And that's a real relationship. That's a real, in the great Pennebaker documentary, The War Room, about the Clinton campaign, you see them, I think you see, sort of see them in the early stages of their relationship, or maybe they're not even dating yet, where she's on the opposing side. And so there's all this sort of fascination, or there was back when this show came out, about their relationship and how they're able to sort of like live together and love one another and be so diametrically opposed politically. So there's that. And then the other thing is that the conceit of the show, the way they did the show, is that they would shoot, my memory of it is it was, they'd shoot Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, edit on Friday and Saturday, and release it on Sunday. You would be watching events that happened in the course of the week that had just happened, right? So in the pilot, when they have debate prep with Howard Dean, then they cut to the Carville and John Slattery, who plays his sort of sidekick, watching the debate happening, and that all had just happened. Like, that was within days of the release of this show. And so you were getting a sort of pseudo-documentary, real-life look at sort of politics as it was happening in the moment. And that was, again, remember, this is 2003. This is not a moment of political apathy. We're talking about the Iraq War has begun, and it was a very sort of politically active time. And, you know, for that reason, I think my memory of it from its time certainly informs how I enjoy it now.
I guess the only show that really does something like this, well, there's, I guess, just two different types. There's Hard Knocks on HBO, which covers the football preseason. And so they film during the week and then edit and then release, and it covers basically the week before. And that is of interest to me because I like the subject matter. But I guess also the only other show that I can think of with this kind of guerrilla filmmaking would be, and this doesn't always do this, but South Park, right? They've been known to cover something that happens on a Sunday night and have an episode out on a Wednesday. So in that facet, I really like it. But because they're doing it so quickly and they have to film a 30-minute episode that's improvised for the most part, or, you know, at least relatively or mostly or whatever, in 3 days, they have to do things quick. And so what really threw me for a loop, and this is going back to what I was saying a little bit before, it feels like, and it's shot like, and they sort of act like it's a Christopher Guest movie. And it's the way they deliver lines, it's the way they jump from scene to scene, it's the way they do this, it's the way they do that. So it's shot in that mockument. I'm sure that a lot of things are shot like that. But my brain, what it went to first was Christopher Guest. And I was like, where are all the jokes? Because the way that it's shot, this sort of improvised, cutting from room to room, sort of, here's these people talking about this thing, here's these people talking about this other similar thing, that's what I had in my mind. So like I was waiting, and it felt like, to me, they wanted to be funny, sort of, and it just wasn't. At least for me, and it just wasn't clicking. Like, the way that they were telling the story and the way that they were sort of acting, it just didn't work. And I was watching, and I just couldn't find a way in.
I think you hit on something I had an issue with, too, and it didn't click until, like, it took, like, 3 or 4 episodes for me for this show to actually, like, start clicking and understanding in a way, like, how it wants me to watch it. But, like, it just drops you into this world of politics, and I really just fell in over my head from the jump. And, you know, you're dealing with these people talk, they might as well be talking another language because I have no idea what they're talking about. You know, they're referring to all these things and these events and like the news and stuff. And it's like, all right, whatever. And I just kind of feel like I've got to go with it until it's like being in another country. And like, you know, after a while, you pick up that language and you're able to sort of work your way around the streets and at least get to the airport to get yourself back home or something. So I did have trouble engaging with it initially. What I stuck with it with for was pretty much like the filmmaking style. Like I was intrigued by how they're able to cover current events. I was intrigued with the sort of go for substance over style. You know, like this is just a matter of convenience that we can shoot this on digital and get this out, and it's a good way to do this project. I was just really hoping that somewhere along the line, the story picked up in an interesting direction. I feel like the laughs get there eventually. Like, I find Carville pretty funny, like, just as a guy, as a person, like, being himself. He kind of interests me. I like watching him, like, on talk shows and things. I like seeing Bill Hader do an impression of him on Weekend Update and thing. So there were things in there that were keeping me engaged. And at one point, I just was like, by episode 5, I was like, well, I'm halfway there. I'm just going all the way. And it just, like Tobin said, it ended in, like, kind of more of a whimper. They start getting, like, investigated by the FBI. I couldn't really follow, like, a lot of what they were doing as a job, necessarily. Like, I know they're lobbyists, but I really didn't know, like, what they did day-to-day that helped them earn money. So, like, I was hoping some of that stuff would get explained along the way, but it's not. You just have to keep up with it.
The only other political show that's on the air at this point is West Wing, and this is sort of the anti-West Wing. And I think going into it, I think, Joey, you were poisoned by learning that someone described it as a comedy. I think there are funny things in here. This is a procedural quasi-docudrama with laughs. That's what it is. And the laughs come from as you get to know the characters. And James Carville is just such a fascinating guy. I mean, the whole goal was to feel like you were just in the room watching this stuff happen. Like, this would be happening no matter what, and we just happened to be there. And I think that it's, I don't know that everybody would have the feeling like, oh, this is Christopher Guest. I think some people would think, oh, this is a documentary. Oh, what we're watching is real. Not that it's sort of been staged. And so much of it is real. I mean, that's actual debate prep with Howard Dean. Like, you never get to see actual debate prep with a presidential primary candidate. It just doesn't happen. It certainly wouldn't happen today. And to see it, like, the week that it happened was amazing to see. And those sorts of moments, that there's a moment later on when they are under investigation. There's an FBI series, a bunch of FBI agents are interviewing Carville and Carville's lawyer. And Carville's lawyer is played by, I believe, a real DC power lawyer. And then you have the FBI agents who were former FBI agents, and they actually, like, they're enacting it. What they're talking about, the scandal they're talking about there, is made up. But you can see how, when you're under that kind of investigation, you're not told what you're being investigated for. So So part of what Carvel and his lawyer are trying to figure out is, like, what are they looking for? We didn't even know what they're after. And the disorientation of that and the way that just sort of learning how that stuff actually works is, I think, pretty fascinating.
Look, I almost wish that they went full documentary on this to a degree, or made it more obvious that it was fictional or fictionalized, or, you know, whatever you want to, part fiction based on real events happening at the time. And, like, that was a very interesting scene when he's being interviewed by those FBI agents in the office and everything, because it was almost the whole episode, and it was one of the moments where you're just like, wow, like, this is when the show is really working for me.
Right.
But it took like 8 episodes to get there. And then thinking back, I was like, well, there were scenes, you know, that were similar when people were like meeting with lobbyists, or like they're the lobbyists, but when they're meeting with people they want to represent and they're just having like a lunch or something, and you're like, oh, here's where the show is sort of clicking. You almost wish, well, I almost wished like that it was a little more... just go full documentary for me, for my taste.
I think that the tough thing for me with this is that there's obviously a value in seeing the pieces that laid the groundwork for shows and movies and stuff that exist today. But this, even though it still touches on things, like as we're recording this, there's something in the news about people meeting with Russian lawyers that, you know, sort of feels relevant with the stories of this. But, like, if you're not of that time and don't really know this kind of thing, it's difficult, for me at least, to find value in this when I could just watch a season of Veep instead. That I know that without this, Veep might not exist, or Veep might be different, or whatever, especially since they're both on HBO. What's interesting about K-Street is that it's not on HBO Go. Like, it just doesn't, like, I guess HBO just sort of wiped it. And I think even, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure, like, even Mr. Show is on HBO Go, and Mr. Show is, like, HBO's bastard stepchild that, like, they don't want to talk about. Like, that's still up there.
It's a rights issue, as I understand it. The reason it can't be on HBO Go.
Oh. Rights issue between who?
Between the producers of the show. I don't know all the... Huh. When I was in film school and the show debuted, Mary Madeline and James Carville and one of the quote-unquote writers, as far much of the show has writers, came and presented a couple episodes and talked about that. And there was some... I just remember there being something unusual about the deal that they had with HBO, because it was such an experiment, right? And the other thing is that we're talking about the raw look of it. That is... mostly Soderbergh and Clooney with the cameras. Like, it literally was just them and a sound guy, like, crawling around the room and trying to grab shots and make stuff up as it went. Like, and to work it into the actual work that was going on in Carvel and Madeline's, you know, life at the time. And in terms of the Don Jr. stuff, that's what's in the news now about the Russian lawyers and everything. The Valerie Plame affair does get brought into this. There's some point when, because Mary Madeline had worked in real life, had worked in the George W. Bush administration, and was somehow tangentially involved in the outing of, didn't out Valerie Plame as a CIA officer, but she was wrapped up in that scandal somehow. And that plays here. And at the time, that was a huge deal. So I think you're right, Joey, that if you're not sort of politically aware of that moment, it's not going to resonate. It would be the same thing as if you had something happening now and you tried to show it to your kids later on. They'd be like, well, I don't know what that means. I don't care. These scandals, as big as they are not the sort of epic scandals of Watergate or potentially what's going on now that might resonate, you know, for years and years and years. But at the moment, it was sort of hot button stuff.
But it is kind of like a time capsule of that era in a way, because of how quickly, like, the 24-hour news cycle has just gotten.
Right.
I mean, even at 2003, where whenever this was airing, like, it was, even though it was vaguely like in its infancy, you could say, to a degree, like, it was still very much like bombarding you with information much more than I feel like people were used
to.
And so, like, that is kind of interesting that you could go back and look at these particular weeks in history and kind of be reminded of, like, what was on people's mind and, you know, what were considered scandals at the time and all that kind of stuff.
What I like about doing podcasts like this, like Cage Club and Keanu Club and Cinemakers, is being able to go back in time and see these movies and see how either an actor or a director evolves. And then once we see the thing, then going deep in IMDb and be like, oh, like, I didn't know that this was what happened, or this was inspired by this, or, you know, this actor's almost in it or whatever. I feel like with this one, it's so different in a way that it's almost you have to do all that research before you see it. Like, I would have liked to have known before I watched it that, like, it was Soderbergh and Clooney just in the room with the camera. You know what I mean? Like, I would have liked to know more of the backstory, but I don't want to do that level of research and sort of spoil things for myself in one way or another before I watch whatever I'm going to watch. Like, I want to go in blind. I want to know, okay, how am I going to trace Soderbergh's evolution as a director and, you know, editor and cinematographer and all this different stuff. And then we get here and the first 3 minutes are a guy getting his shoes shined. And I'm just like, oh, this isn't like, I don't want this.
Yeah. I think to a degree that maybe they went a little too insider. Like, it's too behind the scenes. It's not as accessible as sort of like a network show would want to make, like The West Wing. Like, it doesn't want you to be comfortable and like get what's going on. It wants you to sort of be like, did I miss something? Is something happening? But I don't necessarily like feeling that way while I'm watching a show all the time. I mean, it's got to be like a really good show to sort of put me through those feelings I feel. I just feel like they could have done a lot to make it more accessible and not sort of like sacrifice any of their artistic integrity, perhaps, you know, and, you know, maybe just have the character like Francisco who comes in, make him be the cipher for the audience and need things explained to him. And that way we can pick up on like who certain people are, what's important, and, you know, the focus of that episode.
So here's the problem with that is that they didn't know in terms of the story with the characters. Oh, okay. Like, John Slattery has talked about in the first episode or two, at some point they're on a train, and other times he's like just staring out the window. And I think Carvel asks him, like, you okay? You like, get in the game, buddy. We gotta, you know, he has some sort of pep talk speech. And apparently it's because that's what's actually happening on set. Is John Slattery is like, I don't have a clue what I'm doing here. Like, I don't know who I am. I don't know what's going on. So they incorporate that into the show and then come up with the woman in the red dress that begins to appear and his whole deal with his wife and like that stuff.
Right,
that,
he's a sex addict.
Right.
Right.
Right. And, yeah. And that stuff all sort of emerged because the whole idea is they were going to find that stuff as they went along. And I agree. I don't think it's very successful. I think there's a reason that they only made one season of this show, and then they would go on to make, what was the one that there was, I forget the name of it. The one that Clooney was sort of the lead on that was about actors. I think Ben Greenberg was in it. And
oh, what's the making thing with Affleck and Damon?
No,
not Project Greenberg.
No.
It's
this exact same kind of thing, except that you're just watching these actors' lives. It's got a one word title. It's something like Actors. Anyway, and that one was purely, they used this documentary style, but was just the fictional story, and they had worked out the story more, and in that way it was sort of more successful in a more narrative sense. I still think that I would rather see Soderbergh experiment with something like this than see the bland version of the show. And maybe what I'd rather see is the much more insidery show where they don't try and wrap anything up. And you're boy, like the Michael Mann version of the show where you're just like, you're left to your own devices to figure out what the hell is going on. But again, I may be unusual in that case. Joey wouldn't like that, but I think I could get behind that.
So between this show and Getting Away With It, the book that he interviews Richard Lester and does his diary while he's making Schizopolis and Grey's Anatomy, basically, I'm realizing that, like, Soderbergh is a really interesting person. Like, I mean, we obviously knew that he was interesting to do for this because he's so unique and so sort of all-encompassing in his projects. But, like, there's just certain things that I'm just not going to click with at all. Full Frontal is that way, and this is that way, and, like, the stuff he's talking, like, the way that he comes off in the book, it's very, like, he's very himself. And in a way that really worked for me as this young guy making sex lies and just sort of being blown away by the reception, here, he's had some success, and, like, he's still that same type of guy, but sort of a little bit, not arrogant, but, like, he's more confident, and it was difficult to get through. And there's stuff he's done that we're going to get up to that I love. Like, the movies are going to keep being great, but it's these ideas, it's these passion projects, it's these way that he approaches things, whether it's a diary or whether it's an interview with Richard Lester or whether it's making a TV show like K Street or a movie like Full Frontal, where I'm just like, oh, like, I know why you want to do this and I like that he's passionate about it, but it's not for me. And I think that it's something that we sort of didn't really see yet when we do an actor, because, like, we have an actor in, like, a weird or bad movie, you're like, oh, maybe he just wanted money, maybe he got, you know, like, Keanu sort of got, like, roped into some contract and, like, he had to be in this movie or whatever. Here, it's like, this is what the guy wants, like, this is the project he wants to make, and he has control over all of it, and, like, it's not always going to click for me, I guess.
I'm actually really down with him experimenting with, like, video and digital. Like, ever since the beginning with Sex Lies, it's a film and video movie, you know? Like, clearly he's, like, all for one when it comes down to the media. I like that about him, that he's, like, nonconformist in that way, that he doesn't need to shoot on film. Like,
which I like. I like that about it, yeah.
Yeah, but I also feel like maybe with the incredible success that he has had, right? Like, currently, like, which probably opened the door for him to be able to do K Street, to be so close with Clooney and all this stuff. You know, success maybe got to him a little bit, and it was just his chance to say, well, now's my time to kind of go crazy and do this show and do Full Frontal, which I like this more than Full Frontal. Like, my problem with that wasn't exactly the way it was shot. It was more just the plot and story and stuff that I didn't really like. Like I said, like, I don't hate this. I don't love it. I enjoy aspects of it, but I almost wish that Clooney made another movie after Solaris or something, you know, like kept going in that direction. But
well, the next movie he does is with Clooney. So, I mean, like, maybe this is just, it's hard because, like, in the book, if nothing else, you realize how much he's doing at one time, especially, like, you know, the book sort of covers like 96, 97. So it's a couple years before this, but like, he's doing Schizopolis, he's doing Grey's Anatomy, you know, he's doing a rewrite on Mimic, he's doing this project called Toots that was going to be made with Tim Burton that never got made. He's jockeying for Out of Sight. Like, he's got 5 or 6 different projects going on here. I mean, they're probably already shooting Ocean's 12 or planning Ocean's 12 or something. I can't imagine that this, I mean, it must have been like an intensive thing, but this probably only took 10 weeks, right? Like, you did 10 episodes and you're done. There's probably prep, but there's nothing after the fact. These 3 months of my life are this show.
Right.
And then while you're doing that, probably in between, he's also, you know, doing casting for Ocean's 12 and all this. Like, it's all sort of overlapping. So I think that this is sort of like a, I think we do sort of go, Mike, from like Clooney movie to Clooney movie. This is just sort of like a weird sort of road bump, speed bump in between.
It's an experiment. And when we, in the actual sense of that word, not all experiments are successful. Like, that's the, and that's, I would so much rather have somebody who makes an occasional or even a fairly frequent interesting experiment that fails than somebody who is just bland, who's boring. Like, I know you guys, in watching particularly through the Keanu Club, you've seen a lot of generic movies. Like, you've seen a lot of things that they just don't have anything sort of to, no style that to stand out. Now, you may not like the style, but one of the things you sort of get with the Soderbergh package is he's going to make some stylistic decisions and then stick with them to the end, whether it sort of kills the material or the material kills him or whatever. And I think that that's, you know, I really do appreciate that about him, and I would prefer that. And, you know, I hadn't really thought to warn you about, Joey, that maybe this would be of its time, because, you know, when you watch things of their time, when you are that time, you forget that it was of a time, right? Like, in my memory, it's, I remember that campaign for president so clearly, and so that stuff sort of sticks in my head. And I think, you know, it's interesting to think about where this does fit in his filmmaking DNA. You can trace it back not just to Full Frontal, but there's that cocktail party scene in D.C. where Michael Douglas is talking to all the senators and representatives. In traffic. And they're having actual politicians in the scene talking to Michael Douglas. And that's clearly is the seed of this movie. That's where this movie comes from. And my memory in the talk that the filmmakers gave after the screening when I was in film school is that in D.C., the representatives were crawling all over each other to get into the show. Like, it was a very cool thing to be on this show when the show was airing. And we'll see, you know, this kind of experimentation is going to find its way, sort of working with non-actors and docudrama style is going to, we're going to see that in Magic Mike. We're going to see that, you know, in movies that don't necessarily feel like they would have that. We're going to see some of this movie's DNA crop up in there. And I think that sometimes that style is really going to work for him. And we're going to see something and say, oh, this is where that led to. And that's, I'm so glad he had that crash and burn for Joey experiment that led to this thing. And other times it's going to be like, wow, that didn't work here either. Like, find a new trick.
Well, I think what's weird to me, and I think it shouldn't be weird, like, it should be obvious that this is not always going to be the case, but I feel like, both for myself and for, like, the general movie-going population, you see, like, a movie poster for an upcoming movie with, like, an actor on it that you like. You're like, oh, I want to go see that movie because Tom Cruise is in it, or Nicolas Cage is in it, or whoever. And then you get to the movie, and, like, it's, you know, Nicolas Cage has made 80 movies or whatever with 75 different directors. You're like, oh, these are all over the place. And just because he's in it doesn't mean that it's going to be a good movie. Like, how many movies have I seen recently that have, like, casts that are, like, 5 or 6 or 7 deep with people I love, and I just can't stand the movie because of one factor or another? I thought, even though this is very patently untrue, that, like, with directors, you're much more close. Like, you know that when you see, like, a Tarantino movie, it's all going to be sort of similar. Like, it's going to be super stylized, super slick, violent, aggressive, for a while, sort of, you know, structured out of order, all that kind of stuff. Across the board, I like his movies. I like some more than others, and I like some less than others, but so on and so forth. Here, I was sort of thinking the Soderbergh movies that I'd seen leading up to us doing this, I'd really liked almost all of them. And I was like, oh, I'm probably going to like all these. And then here we are, you know, sort of halfway through our run, and I found a few more that I really like, and I've also found a few that I never want to think about again. I mean, it's obvious that somebody who's made 30 things and is as sort of determined to his vision as Soderbergh is, that he's not always going to make things that appeal to everyone who likes his earlier stuff. But to me, it still surprises me when, like, somebody that I know is supremely talented, that has made things that I love, turns around and makes something like this, and I'm like, oh, I thought we had a thing going.
Yeah.
Like, I thought you and
What'd
I
you do to me?
Were, like, in sync. Like, right. I thought that you were making things almost, not exclusively for me to like, but what you did I was going to like, or I could talk myself into liking, you know? But I guess another director set that we're going to do later in the show sometime is the Coen brothers, and I guess that's the same thing there. Like, a lot of their stuff is really great, and then you get some things you're like, what happened here? So I think it's my own mental roadblock that I need to get past, but it still surprises me when I have a director that I love make something and I'm like, oh, I can't find anything in this that I like.
Well, I think what's good about that, about certain directors, when they reach outside their comfort zone, yes, sometimes you get, you know, stuff you can't stand, but then other times you're going to get stuff that's just, like, incredible. Like, they might have learned something from that experience that made them go another direction the next time, but they're constantly, that Soderbergh is going to, for the most part, constantly just keep trying to stretch himself, like, push himself out of his comfort zone from time to time. Like, he's going to get to a movie with Clooney that, like, takes place in the 40s, and he's like, okay, we're only going to use equipment that was available during this time
right.
to make this movie,
right.
you know? The Good German, when we get there. So he could take the easy route, you know, every time. Like, I'm sure he could do, like, Ocean's 11 half the time if he really put his mind to it, but he doesn't want to do something like that, because then it just makes him less special when those movies hit, when you get something like Magic Mike that comes up, or like just something unexpected and you're like, whoa, he did it, like he reached and he achieved. But it is, yeah, it's disconcerting when you're so into like a certain director, or whether it be a musician or something like that. Like, you know, if I could talk U2 to you for a second, I mean,
oh,
I remember
okay.
when that Zootopia album came out. I know it's Zooropa, but I call it Zootopia. You know, people went out of their minds because it just wasn't the U2 that they wanted. I happen to like that album, but that's just an example, like, of, you know, them just trying to play outside their comfort zone. So sometimes you hit and sometimes you miss. Sometimes you get K Street.
I obviously have no more notes about K Street, because my 6 notes were like, I don't get it. Why is this happening? I don't like this. I'm stopping. Is there anything else in terms of the show or the production or anything that would sort of help people? I do think that, like, there's probably value in this. I don't think this is something that everybody or even most people should go find. If you want to watch it sort of as an experiment, I think that there's value there. But is there anything that, like, people should know before they watch this that will either be like, oh, that's a cool fact, or anything that's going to sort of help them sort of find an entry point into all this nonsense?
In retrospect, I wish that what I had done, or would do now, if someone said, hey, I'm going to go watch K Street, what should I do for homework before I watch it? I would say go on YouTube and watch from those couple months, watch a few nightly news broadcasts to see what was happening in the news at the time. And I think that would some of the names that come up, some of the things that happen would sort of ring with you a little more, that it would sort of put you in that time. And then just do understand that what you are watching is a time capsule of that period, and a real baptism by fire, you know, walk the tightrope kind of production that deliberately was trying to be messy and scrappy and find its way and maybe a little cheeky and know that it's not a comedy. It's not intended to be Veep.
Stop lying to me, IMDb.
So that's what I would say, is familiarize yourself a little bit with what was happening at the time, and then know that what you're watching is to be appreciated, and or for some moments to be maybe not quite revelatory, but, you know, like a window into how things actually work, and that the rest of it is he's trying things that some of which he might used to better effect later, and some of which you'll never go back to.
I feel like, having only seen one episode, but like hearing you guys talk about it, I feel like I either would want this show, like if this show was either more documentary, like I think Mike said, or more fictionalized, I would like it more. Like if it was like Veep, that sort of tackled kind of tackles current events but sets it in like a fully fictional world, I think it would be more timeless. But the fact that they're using real people that I'm familiar with but don't really know, it's like, it already sort of sets me off. And I'm just like, it sets me off balance. And I'm like, I don't feel like I've done the homework. Like, it's like there's a pop quiz. I'm like, oh, I don't, like, I'm vaguely familiar with things, but I don't know enough to watch this. And I feel like if it was nothing real, if it was, everything was like identical except, you know, instead of talking about Howard Dean, they were talking about Doward Heen or something. You know what I mean? Just some, like, that if you were aware of that time, you could be like, oh, that's obviously Howard Dean, that's obviously George W. Bush, whatever. I think it's a cool idea that they're setting it in the real world and you're watching actual Fox News broadcasts or whatever of the debates. But, like, I felt like I was out of my depth, and, like, especially now, 14 years later, it's like, oh, it's this weird, very specific 3-month time stretch that I can't get into.
Yeah, I actually feel like if they had just scripted character beats out beforehand, they may have found their direction sooner and it may have been more clear or realized. Like, that's the thing about improv that's tricky, is like, from my understanding, someone who doesn't perform improv but like hears about a lot of behind the scenes about how those types of shows are made in movies, like, there are bullet points and, you know, character backgrounds, and people come up with, like, characters and stories about themselves, and then they go into the situation which they have to improvise their way through and work their way through. I think that's how they run Curb Your Enthusiasm a lot, right? Is that, like, this certain thing needs to happen, but however we get there is up to you, kind of thing. And if they had just known where they wanted the show to end, they probably could have knocked it out of the park. I just feel that little scripted element would have gone a long way. I don't necessarily think TV is Soderbergh's strength. Like, this, the Showtime show, he will return with the Nick and the Girlfriend Experience. So, just not a format that he has a handle on right now. I think it's something to do with length, like the idea that the show can just keep going and going, and, you know, you just have to decide when to end it, whereas with his movies, they just feel more complete, like, they resolve better. Like, that to me is the thing. There just didn't feel like there was a resolution here. I would have rather just have had the James Carville show and no real actors involved. And you can still, you know, do it like The Office. That would have been hilarious if it was James Carville but The Office, and, you know, everything was just unintentionally hilarious because their boss is just crazy. I don't know. Yeah, for whatever reason, though, it just happens to miss the mark.
I think one of the reasons those other shows maybe work better than this one, or another reason that those do, connects with something that you just said, Mike, which is that TV is, and I think this is true, is more traditionally a writer's medium, and film is more of a director's medium. And he's not using writers in the way that TV usually uses writers in this show. And when you get a show like The Nick, those writers had that show before Soderbergh became involved. And then he then becomes the creative force behind the direction and how it's made and how it's produced and how it sounds and how it looks and all that stuff. But in terms of the John Amiel and his co-writer came up with the show, pitched the show, wrote the pilot at least, and I think that's going to make the shows better. As with some of his movies, as I've argued before in this podcast, some of his Soderbergh's best movies are ones where he's had a strong writer who has sort of helped, given him something to then interpret through the sort of making of the film. You know, another sort of descendant of this show is The Newsroom on HBO. Did you guys ever watch that Aaron Sorkin show?
I watched the first season because of Emily Mortimer.
The creator of West Wing makes this show for HBO a few years later, after this show. And the premise is that there's this behind the scenes of a newsroom, and they're going to be using the actual news, but from like 3 months before. So you're watching, like, and it's a drama. It's not a comedy, although it's Aaron Sorkin, so there's lots of, you know, quote unquote funny in it. And as that show moved into its second, did it have 3 seasons or just 2? I can't remember.
I think it had 3.
It moved into its later seasons, it began to abandon that conceit of the old news. They created their own news events to sort of, which worked so much better because then you weren't having to think back 3 months to remember what that news was like. And like, it didn't, you know, it just felt so old. But anyway, that show, you can see that a little bit of that show, which also is not as successful as his other work in K Street. Joey, what I'm curious about is if you could put this on Letterboxd in the rankings, would you put it at the end or
yeah.
or?
Oh wow!
Because I would rather rewatch. Well, okay, so
full frontal
different things. I think so.
I wouldn't.
So number one, like, the fact that this is 5 hours long, like, I just have no interest in spending that much time with the show. That I'd rather rewatch something that's sort of more compact. Full Frontal has like people that I recognize doing things that resemble things that I like.
Yeah, it has the sound and the furor.
Yes.
So that's an almost, yeah, now I'm starting to read.
There's things about that that are like, oh, I could just a little bit more and then we get the Hitler comedy or whatever, or just a little bit more and we get the Brad Pitt, David Fincher scene that like doesn't work in the movie, but like at least there's that. Here, like I watched the pilot twice and I was just like, I just can't, there's nothing about it. Like it's not like bad. Like, it doesn't offend me. Like I don't think this is like really poorly made. I think that, you know, for what he was doing, it's sort of like he achieved his vision. It's just a show that I would put on and be like, oh, I don't have a desire to go back to this. So just for time alone, I would put this last generously, maybe a little bit higher, but like not really, not much higher.
I probably would too. I think I
you have it last.
Yeah, probably.
You're like this show's defender, though. And
yeah, I know. Well, that's why I was curious, because I think that I either last, or I would put it like just after Solaris, three from the end. Maybe I would watch this again before Grey's Anatomy, the Underneath and Full Frontal. Like maybe I would watch this first. You know, it would bounce back and forth for me, but it's definitely in the bottom like four of the things that we've seen. I do like it better than that other TV episode from
the
Showtime.
Quiet Room, yeah.
It is longer, I know, and like, I don't want to lose 5 hours of my life, you know, but I do like it. I do think it's more accomplished than that. That does feel like bland Soderbergh, and that's no good at all. But I would definitely put this at the bottom. Like I said, I don't necessarily like this show, but I really do appreciate it. I'm glad to have seen it again. I'm probably not going to watch it again.
Because I think that if we were putting together a list, and this is a list that I do not like, but whenever there's like the best things, like objectively, like this is his best film or whatever, like I don't care about that. Like I just want to see like what's my favorite. Because in my head, if you're talking about the best film, in theory, there should be one list that everyone agrees on in some aspect. And I think in that kind of list, this is just somewhere in the middle. Like it's not great, but it's, you know, it's fine. I just think that in terms of what I like, this checks off zero boxes.
Exactly. I feel the exact same way. Yep.
It's tough because, like, I like this more than, say, The Underneath or Full Frontal, but, yeah, I wouldn't watch it again before those because of the length and everything. But I'd actually, if he would do, like, a Soderbergh cut of all of this footage into, like, a two-hour movie, that might be okay. I might rewatch that one day, but I don't think that's ever going to happen.
I'm just excited for his good ventures into TV, that as we're recording this, we are in the midst of watching 26 hours of a Zac Efron TV show for Zac Attack. And so I'm curious to see how we're going to cover, you know, 20 hours of The Nick or 5 hours or whatever of The Girlfriend Experience, which is like a show that has things that we're going to like, and there's sort of more artistic directorial choices. And
oh, careful now. Careful about that. There are a lot of artistic choices in this show.
Artistic choices that I like.
There we go. Now we're talking.
But like things that, you know, that there's more from, at least from me, to comment on. Then I'm curious to see how we're going to do that as opposed to this, where it just feels like this is never going to, like, does it really evolve or change? Or is it sort of like it's this kind of for 5 hours?
No, it does change. They begin to find some things that work better. It's just that the story that they begin to weave out of the sort of seeds they've planted early on in terms of the narrative stuff, that doesn't really come to anything. That's the disappointing thing at the end. They begin to build this whole mystery around, you know, where Francisco comes from and what his whole deal is, and he's working for, who is he working for? Elliot Gould, and what his whole deal is, but you never come anywhere near an answer to that necessarily, and it ends very sort of disappointingly. I think, Joey, what you were excited for is to get to shows that you've seen all of.
Well, I haven't seen those shows. Oh, yes. Oh, but also, yes. That's right. Oh, yeah, yes. I understand what you mean now.
That
yes.
You can stick through, yeah.
That I can actually talk about, yes.
Yes, yeah.
Yes, I'm excited for that. So any last thoughts, Mike, about K-Street, or can we put this in our rear view forever and ever?
I'm down with that. I don't need to drive down K-Street.
What's weird is that, like, looking for a picture for this for our site, like, there's just nothing. Like, it just doesn't exist. So, like, I have a picture of the actual K-Street sign in Washington, D.C., because, like, that's all that exists on the internet. So even the internet, like, this has been scrubbed from history. So,
well, even the DVD is a standard definition version of a widescreen show. And I guess they matted it for HBO so it looks more cinematic. But when you watch it on TV, or at least on my television, it's like a super small letterbox, like in the middle of my screen. And I'm watching the show through like the tiny window.
Well, next week we have Eros, which is a 40-minute short along with two other shorts, it's going to be something romantically involved. So we'll see. We're in a sort of a weird little stretch, I think, for Soderbergh. So this is, hopefully next week we'll sort of be on the uptick. But then we have Ocean's 12, which is, even if it's not my favorite Ocean's movie, it's a sort of a, another swing for the fences, really big, flashy movie that I'm excited to see again. So stay tuned. I'm not going to be as depressed or annoyed, I don't think. Maybe next week, I don't know.
Well, it's only 40 minutes, so how annoyed could you be?
I mean, I'm probably pretty annoyed. I only watched 30 minutes of this and I already hate it. So I
True. Fair enough.
So for all things Cinemakers Union, cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or at cageclubpod on Twitter, you can see all the shows from the series. You can see all the other shows that we've talked about. This is coming out on Christmas. Merry Christmas, everybody, if you celebrate that. So this month, we also have episodes of Boyfriend Material and Magic Mike's out now. So go listen to those. Maybe there's another show out. I don't know. Things happen in real time. So just go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub or at Cage Club Pod on Twitter for all the latest and greatest. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I am Tobin Addington.
And we'll see you next time on Cinemakers.